Welcome to today's edition of Time in the Vineyard with pastor teacher Jeff Torring. Today's broadcast is being brought to you from the pulpit of Liberty Valley Church, Northfield, Ohio.
Joel 3, and we'll begin reading in verse 1. For behold, in those days, and in that time, when I shall bring again the captivity of Judah and Jerusalem, I will also gather all nations, and will bring them down into the valley of Jehoshaphat, and will plead with them there for my people, and for my heritage Israel, whom they have scattered among the nations and parted my land. And they have cast lots for my people, and have given a boy for an harlot, and sold a girl for wine, that they might drink. Yea, and what have ye to do with me, O Tyre and Zidon, and all the coasts of Palestine? Will ye render me a recompense? And if ye will recompense me, swiftly and speedily will I return your recompense upon your own head. Because ye have taken my silver and my gold, and have carried into your temples my goodly pleasant things. The children also of Judah and the children of Jerusalem have ye sold unto the Grecians, that ye might remove them far from their border. Behold, I will raise them out of the place whither ye have sold them, and will return your recompense upon your own head. And I will sell your sons and your daughters into the hand of the children of Judah, and they shall sell them to the Sabaeans, to people far off, for the Lord hath spoken it. I asked the girls to sing that song this morning, the mercy seat, which is a picture of then the judgment seat for the Christians, where we are not judged according to our sin, of course, but we are judged and given out our gifts for the things that we have done for service for the Lord. And I picked that today because that is what's happening here in Joel chapter 3. Some of you may say, well, you just read Joel chapter 3, and I don't see the mercy seat. I don't see anything like that taking place at all. That's why we did it, because in the midst of all the tribulation and all the troubles of Joel in what we call the tribulation, we're not here. The church is gone. Instead of on earth suffering from things like a virus and like plagues and pestilence and things like that, which is happening here in Joel, the good part about that is that while all this is happening, we as Christians are at the marriage feast of the Lamb. We are experiencing a wedding party like no other party. We are experiencing getting our rewards. We're receiving our crowns. We're getting prepared for the coming millennium. And so we have to keep that in mind then, as while we're finishing the book of Joel and learning all the things that are taking place on the earth, Solomon said there's an evil under the sun, and so we're told to set our affections on things above. So even though there's an evil under the sun, we as Christians are not supposed to focus on that. We're supposed to set our affections on things above. And so while all this is happening to the catastrophe down below, up above is where we're going to be. When we look at this, what I'd like to do is just kind of put together some loose ends. I did the final chapter in a chronological order on purpose so that we can see how this goes. Last week we dealt with a considerable amount of the War of Armageddon, the final putting in of the reaper, and saying to put in and the grapes are ripe. And so what I'd like to do now is just in a chronological order kind of re-go through some of these things. There'll be some loose ends, and we would like to just tie them together. What we find in verse 1, he says, "For behold, in those days, and in that time, when I shall bring again the captivity of Judah and Jerusalem." We're here into a place, it's their home, they're going to be returned to home, but it's going to be a return in a situation of suffering. I just read recently in the Epoch Times, a newspaper that is relatively new, and I recommend that if you read the newspaper to maybe subscribe to this new newspaper called the Epoch Times. It has history inside of it in a section, and it had the history of a Jewish family right after World War II. And he was living actually quite well in Iraq. They're an Iraqi family, although they're Jewish, and they were living quite well in Iraq right at the end of World War II. And because of the war, and because of the Nazis, and because of the turmoil, the Iraqis banished all the Jews out of their land. So they were removed as like an exile, and they were forced to actually go home. Now, God was behind it. He was making them all. He was gathering his people back home slowly but surely all the way since back in the 1940s. But when they got finally home, it wasn't pleasant. They were relatively wealthy, good, successful people when they were living in Iraq. They came to Jerusalem. There's nothing. That they came home to a wasteland. They ended up living in refugee camps and tents with nothing to do, barely anything to eat, but they're home. Here's something similar. God is returning all the Jews home, but it's to a situation of suffering. Pontius Pilate, when Jesus was standing before him, after he gave the death sentence, said, "I am innocent of the blood of this just man." And they cried out, "His blood be upon us and our children." And it has been ever since. The Jew has suffered tremendously. And so here they are suffering. But they're coming back home for the purpose of the crescendo. But in verse 2 it says, "I will also gather." So not only the Jews are being gathered at home, it says, "I will gather all nations and will bring them down into the valley of Jehoshaphat." Now what I'd like to do is just pull some pieces together concerning the valley of Jehoshaphat, the location that we're talking about. Because what you're going to say is you're going to talk to people about this, especially in the time that it is now, the end times, which everybody thinks that we're in. You're going to say, well, the thing was in Jehoshaphat, the valley of Jehoshaphat. That's what Joel says. Gather them to the valley of Jehoshaphat. And then somebody's going to say, well, I thought it was at actually Armageddon, the valley of Megiddo. And then you're going to be like, well, yeah, but those aren't the same places. So what I'd like to do is just take a minute so that we can learn. Throw your ribbon in here and we'll come right back. But I'd like to just show you something from Mark 9 and Jesus' teachings that'll kind of clarify some of these things. In Mark 9, Jesus gives a very strict, solemn warning. Jesus was actually pretty harsh. For a loving shepherd, he said things that were pretty harsh to people. You know, like, bring those servants here that wouldn't obey me and kill them before me. He said harsh things. Jesus was very severe at times and yet very gracious. Here is one of the severe times. Look at it in 42, Mark 9, 42. He says, "And whosoever shall offend one of these little ones, the children that were around him, that believe in me, it is better for him that a millstone were hanged about his neck and he were cast into the sea." That's pretty harsh. Now, people who harm little children deserve that. Amen? They get it, and he's not being gracious to them. But then he says something else as far as the believers go. He says in 43, "If thy hand offend, cut it off. It is better for you to enter into life maimed than having two hands to go to hell, into the fire that never shall be quenched." Now he says an interesting word when he says that. He says the word hell in the original languages is Gehenna. Now Gehenna comes from another word by Gehenim, which comes from another word, the valley of Hinnom. So you can kind of hear the sound of the words and how they trace through in the etymology of it. It starts out with Gehenna, and then it goes, that is taken from Gehenim, and that is taken from an area which is a valley right outside the city called the Valley of Hinnom. Now, when you're thinking of this, in this valley that is right outside the city called the Valley of Hinnom, first of all, look at it in verse 44 when he describes it. He says, "Where their worm dieth not, and the fire is not quenched." Look at it again in verse 46, "where the worm dieth not, and the fire is not quenched." Again in 48, "where their worm dieth not, and the fire is not quenched." In his day, and in a lot of the previous days, and just following, the Valley of Hinnom was a city landfill right outside the city. So, you know, in the old days, you would just take your trash out to the city limits and just dump them in the street. They didn't have this huge garbage system. And so what we have here is the city landfill was right outside the gate in a valley, a place that they would burn trash. In certain points of history within this valley, it would become a common grave. If too many people died and they were poor and they couldn't afford a tomb, they would just have this valley, this garbage pit, would become a mass grave. And they would burn garbage there. And they would burn people there. They would have cremations there. It was a dump at certain points in history. It was actually a place where aborted babies were taken there to die. Remember in the certain days of the kings, I think it was Ahab, they had this tradition of idolatry where they had a huge basin and they would cause the children to pass through the fire. They fried babies alive. That was their method of abortion. And then they would take the corpses of these hundreds, literally hundreds, if not thousands of babies that were burned alive to a false god, throw them to the Valley of Hinnom, and burn them. Cover them, burn them. There would be trash burning there. The rotting flesh that would be in there would cause worms to come, and the worms, it says, would constantly eat that. This is in the Valley of Hinnom, or Gehenna. So what Jesus is doing is he's actually giving them a live picture of hell. He calls it hell. He's taking this Valley of Hinnom that is a picture of hell and saying that's actually what hell really is like. It's a place where the worm dieth not. The fires are never quenched. It is constantly smoking and it has this stench that comes up. Now, what I'd like to deal with then, when he's talking outside the city, this valley, this location, it's right outside the city. Now, I've been to Israel and a lot of people have, and we've traveled right outside the city. Fortunately now, there's not a bunch of rotting corpses right outside, but the locality is still the same. It's also known as the Kedron Valley. You may remember that when Jesus is leaving, heading over to Gethsemane, and he crosses the brook Kedron. Now, the brook Kedron's an interesting brook because that one is a small little creek that flows through there and heads down to the Dead Sea. Now, during the times when there's massive celebrations, when tens of thousands of Jews would come and they would kill thousands and thousands of lambs and bullocks, the priests then would take that blood from the temple right outside the city to this brook, right in this valley where there's a little river flowing, and dump the used blood. Now, that's disgusting. Actually, when Jesus leaves to head to Gethsemane, he sees all the blood there. He knows that's a picture of his own blood. Could you imagine the eerie feeling as they're walking by and he knows that's a picture of his own blood being shed? The Gethsemane, the garden, is also in the valley. So we're looking at this. The Valley of Jehoshaphat is part of this. So the Valley of Jehoshaphat is about a 20-30 mile strip that is part of Valley of Hinnom. Is part of the Kedron Valley. It is part of Gethsemane. Then if you travel and you go through this valley, you'll end up about 50 miles north of Jerusalem. There's also another valley. It is called the Valley of Jezreel. It is also called the Valley of Megiddo. And it is also called the Valley of Armageddon. Now, what does this all look like to you in your mind? It's like Cleveland, but greater Cleveland. So my bride, when she goes to Cleveland, she thinks, you know, that Cleveland is just about anything outside of the Hudson-Bridgetown area. She's like, I don't know that out there. I'm not familiar with that. That's all the way out in Cleveland. And I'm like, no, that's not Cleveland. That's like Bedford. She's like, yeah, but it's not, you know, and she's like, it's Cleveland. And, you know, it is what it is. And but here's the thing. We have Cleveland, and then we have the west side of Cleveland. Then you have the east side of Cleveland. You have areas, and you're like, well, that's University Circle. But that's not Cleveland. But it is Cleveland. And what it is you have a greater Cleveland area. You have the very downtown of Cleveland, but you have this greater Cleveland area that has different names. And through history, it has actually different, you might have Little Italy, or you have different times where it changes a little bit. So when you're reading through the Bible and you read Jericho, the famous city, there's actually two cities by the name of Jericho. You have original old Jericho, and then you have Jericho. And if you don't know this, it looks like the Bible contradicts itself, because in one place it actually says that Jesus was leaving Jericho and heading into Jericho. So what we're looking at here in the locality is he's saying the Valley of Megiddo, the Valley of Jehoshaphat back in our passage then, What he's saying is there is a huge staging area by the Valley of Megiddo where the War of Armageddon will take place. There will be literally millions upon millions of people in this huge valley similar to Vegas. But this valley then narrows to a smaller valley and it will pour the people. The people literally will look like a sea. There are so many people coming to invade the city of Jerusalem that it will actually from the air will look like water pouring from this big basin through this valley down into another valley and then heading right into the city of Jerusalem for the invasion. So when we come back then to Joel 3, we understand when he says, I will gather all nations and will bring them down into the valley of Jehoshaphat. The valley is actually overflowing. And then he says, and I will plead with them there. This is a guilty plea. They have already made their decision. They are invading. Verse 3, it says, now look, what he does here is Joel recollects probably a very particular historical event where something terrible took place. What's interesting is this is happening. I mean, this is so current right now because of what we're going through with coronavirus. A little thing is taking place. And actually, it's a very little thing. We have currently, I think, 200 confirmed cases in Ohio. We have 11 million people in Ohio. This is like a speck. Yet the behavior is incredibly terrible. Some people who are honest enough have actually said from the Wall Street Journal that this is so badly overblown, this could actually ruin the entire country financially. We have already lost over $1 trillion. Now, I've been studying war for quite some time. I read books on the strategies of war. I read what the generals have said. And I don't know if it's because that I have been in such study that I look at this. But this is normal, natural war. Here's what the generals come together and do. All right. In war, there's casualties. Can't get around it. The idea there is we're going to make a strategy where we lose as little amount of people so that we can gain the victory. Now, that sounds cold, but this is the truth. Basically, these boys here are expendable. We're going to lose lives here in this battle on purpose so that we end up winning the full war. That all wars have gone that way. All of them. Right now, we are in a war. And the generals, now here's what they say. It's worth it if we don't lose one person. That sounds good. I don't want to lose any lives either. But in war, you're going to take casualties. And so the good top brass is going to decide, do we want to lose this many for the cause of not losing this many? Or do we just want to be foolish and just try to save these and actually lose them all? So somebody from the Wall Street Journal says, hey, I think it may be actually best for the United States if we kind of change things around a little bit before we actually run ourselves amok. Because the rumor, and this is just rumor, you know, where did this come from? It came from China. China is no friend of ours. They will happily sacrifice a few hundred thousand because they have like 500 million. They'll happily, let's just wipe out Wuhan and then send it around the world, especially to the giant. And then we won't tell anybody how it's going. We won't give them what the data is. We'll just hope that it murders half the country. But we don't even need to do that because they'll be so scared. They'll just fall on their own sword. Here, what's happening is the Valley of Jehoshaphat has taken place, a particular current event that he's responding to. He's saying, look, the people behaved so badly during this event that they began, in verse 3, it says, they cast lots for the people and have given a boy for an harlot. That is terrible behavior. We're interested in a nighttime with a harlot, and we're going to give a boy for it. We're going to sell a girl for a glass of wine, because the wine is so precious at this time that we'll actually sell a little girl. Bring this into what's happening today as we're heading towards Armageddon, which I don't know, it could be 200-300 more years, or it could be 20, or it could be 5. But look what he says here in 4. Yea, and what have ye to do with me, O Tyre and Sidon, and all the coasts of Palestine? Now let's just put this in today. So Tyre and Sidon is modern day Lebanon, still an enemy of Israel. Palestine is the Gaza Strip. Now we hear about that all the time on the news. This is what we call the old Philistines that warred with David. Then you have Edom, which is in Obadiah, who's included in this number. Obadiah gives a woe unto Edom, which is Jordan. So what you're seeing here in this particular passage is that you have a very, very terrible time near the end, near Armageddon, where all these Arabian, all the Arab states are beginning to take advantage of the situation that's upon them. We have a little portion in Lamentations chapter 5 when we studied Daniel and we went through that and how there was the captivity and the siege. But Lamentations 5, Jeremiah writes, the siege was so bad and so starving that people actually made a run for it from the city. Now, you are surrounded by a full army, but it doesn't matter. We're starving to death. I mean, we're eating our own young. So it's so bad that Israeli people, one or two or three at a time, would say, forget it. I'm going to make a run for it. And so they left the city and they ran as fast as they could. And Jeremiah records them. He says that they have hunted our steps. They have pursued us in the mountains and they laid wait in wickedness. In other words, what the Arabs did in the surrounding countries at the worst time for Israel, they picked them off. Instead of helping them, who are running for their very lives, men, women, and children, they actually caught them and then sold them as slaves. God doesn't care for that. So he says to them, I'm going to return that recompense upon your own head. Because you have taken my silver and my gold, the economy is wrecked. The world economy. And if you notice, there's nations here. So he notices Tyre and Sidon, Palestine, all the coasts, the economy. They're being sold into the Grecians, so Europe is involved. What's happening here is this is just as Armageddon is taking place and he has put in the sickle and he's killed the big part of people that are up in the Valley of Megiddo who are rushing down. All the blood is flowing down right now. He has already put in the sickle. The angels have announced it. He has put it in. And so now the death toll is just tremendously bad. And what's happening now is he's gathering these people right around the throne. And this is what we're looking at. If you look, he's saying, look, you did this and you did this. Nation, Tyre, Sidon, Lebanon, these nations, you did this, and so now I'm going to do this. What we're looking at here is a judgment of the nations right about the ending time of Armageddon. Go over to Jesus' Olivet Discourse, and he does this here. Look in Matthew 25. Jesus teaches this. Matthew 25:31, when the Son of Man shall come in His glory and all His holy angels with Him, then shall He sit upon the throne of His glory. And look, and before Him shall be gathered all nations. He shall separate them one from another, as a shepherd divides his sheep from the goats. He shall set the sheep on His right hand, but the goats on His left. Then shall the king say unto them on his right hand, Come, ye blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom, the millennium, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. And look, he tells them why. For I was hungered and you gave me meat, I was thirsty and you gave me drink, I was a stranger and you took me in, naked and you clothed me. This is literal. You have people running for their lives, literally, who have been stripped naked. I was sick. You visited me. And I had to stop there. Well, that's a risk, isn't it? Well, you have to keep social distancing, don't you know? These people have the plagues. But because you visited me and risked your life, you're involved in something. I was a stranger, you took me in naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came unto me. Look at this. This is amazing. Then shall the righteous answer unto him, and saying, Lord, when saw we thee hungered, or fed thee, or thirsty, or gave thee drink? When? They don't even know. They don't even know that they did this. He's saying, you did this unto me. And they're like, well, when did we do anything for you? We're not even religious. We're not Christians. We're Arabs. But we're Arabs with a little bit of a heart. Just a little bit. Like, there were people who were not Christians who risked their lives for the Jews in World War II in Germany and risked everything and hid them in their homes. They weren't necessarily Christians. They just had a decent heart. And that's what's happening here. They're not religious. They're just saying, well, when did we do anything for Jesus? When did we do this? In 40, and the king shall answer and say unto them, verily I say unto you, inasmuch as ye have done it unto one of the least of these, my brothers, the Israelites, you have done it unto me. Then shall he say unto them, on the left hand, depart from me, ye cursed, into everlasting fire, where the worm dieth not, and the fires are never quenched, prepared for the devil and his angels. Because I was hungry and you gave me no meat, and I was thirsty and you gave me no drink. Verse 46 again, he says, and these shall go away into everlasting punishment, but the righteous into eternal life. What we're looking at here, brothers, is survivors of Armageddon. These are the survivors. Because what we're seeing here is all the nations will come together for Armageddon. All the military might will gather up. Millions upon millions upon millions will make the march. But here what we're looking at is some of the military actually do survive. If you go further off into the Olivet Discourse, they cry for the rocks to fall on them in the dens and the caves. They hide in the same caves that Osama bin Laden hides in. And in Pakistan and in all the Taliban, they hide in these caves and they survive the seven-year trib. They actually survive the Armageddon. In war. And so now what we're seeing is a few military people who have survived, and we're seeing all the civilians now from all other nations who didn't go to war. They are now also, now because the war is over, they have been summoned. Now every single person is left here. And they are receiving the judgment of the nations. And he's saying, well, you United States citizens, you know, you did try to help the Jews in this trouble, even though you risked your own lives. And because of that, enter into the glory of the kingdom, even though they're non-believers. It's amazing grace, isn't it? That is astounding, amazing grace. They rejected Jesus Christ, but because they, by their own something, they're allowed to live. That's a gracious king. But yet we still have some cleanup to do. Now, if you've been paying attention, which I know you all have because you're good students, every sermon has something to do with stink, right? Like, this guy's just a little bit fascinated with the stink or rotting corpses or, you know, the gruesomeness of it. And actually, I prefer not to, but it's the thread that runs through it. So when he's given his illustration of the masses of locusts, the dead bodies that wash to shore, he said it's a stink, it's a rot, it's a pestilence, it's terrible. Jesus gives the illustration, the valley is going to be like the valley of Hinnom, where there's rotting corpses and the worms and the rot and the fire and the stink. It's constant. So there is some cleanup to do. And actually, look, the same passage in the Olivet Discourse that Jesus teaches, if you go to a page to the left in Matthew 24, 27, he says, again, about the coming of the Lord. He says, for as the lightning cometh out of the east and shineth even unto the west, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. Now look, for wheresoever the carcass is, there will the eagles be gathered together. We're familiar with that. It was about a year ago. We had just a wonderful time in my office. It was so exciting. I have windows on the corner. I have this like corner suite at my house that's all glass. And you know, on the 50th floor. And I sit out and I watch. And so we were all gathered together in my office. And there was a hawk in the backyard. chasing a squirrel, and it was the most amazing thing because this squirrel would climb up the tree and would climb on this side of the tree so that the hawk couldn't see it, and the hawk would swoop down and try to catch it, and then this squirrel was just amazing. I mean, it just was running for its life up and down the tree, up on this side, rolling around on this side, and then we were watching it. I mean, it was like, I mean, exciting. And then finally we were cheering because the thing got away. We're like, proper praise the Lord, and the thing lives another day, this squirrel. And I'm thinking, but wait, but the hawk now is starving to death. And so we had this issue. Vultures and the hawks, and that we know when you see a dead corpse somewhere, or even a deer on the side of the road, you drive by and the crows are all pecking away at it. The cleanup is the stink. And Jesus is saying, when you see the Son of Man come in glory, you're going to also see where the carcass is, you're going to see eagles gathered together. Look over in Revelation and then we'll finally wrap everything up. Revelation 19. We're familiar with it. In verses 11 through 16, Jesus comes back as the king. He's riding on his horse. His eyes were as a flame of fire. His head were many crowns. He had a name written that no man knew but he himself. He was clothed with a vesture dipped in blood, and his name is called the Word of God. And the armies which are in heaven, that's us coming back. After the big festive time where we get our rewards and our own crowns and our own righteous robes, we are enlisted to come back and take the promised land. So the armies which are in heaven followed him upon white horses, clothed in fine linen and white and clean. And out of his mouth goeth a sharp sword, and that which should smite the nations and shall rule them with a rod of iron. He treads the winepress in the fierceness of the wrath of the Almighty God. He hath on his vesture and on his thigh a name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. There's putting in the sickle. Now the cleanup. The judgment of the nations has taken place. That's in between verse 16 and 17. Now afterward, we're going to go into the millennium. But before we do that, there's a cleanup. And I saw an angel standing in the sun, and he cried with a loud voice, saying to all the fowls that fly in the midst of heaven, come and gather yourselves together unto the supper of the great God, that ye may eat the flesh of kings, and the flesh of captains, and the flesh of mighty men, and the flesh of horses, and them that sat on them, and the flesh of all men, both free and bond, both small and great. It's the cleanup. But there's always a little rascal when you do war, isn't there? You have this picture sometimes, you know, where it's like the Wizard of Oz. Everybody thought there was some big, great thing at Wizard of Oz. And then you look behind the curtain and it's just this coward, you know. This is the illustration that's happening now. We have the hugest, most vast war. God comes, wipes them all out. Vultures are coming to clean up the carcasses and the mess. And there's a couple of runts that are walking around. And I say that truthfully, yet respectfully. But there's a couple of runts. Verse 19, and I saw the beast and the kings of the earth and their armies gathered together to make war against him that sat on the horse and against his army. And of course, Psalm 2, the Lord shall laugh at that. Why do the heathen rage? The Lord will just laugh. He'll have them in confusion and derision. And then here's the best part. 20. And the beast was taken, and with him the false prophet that wrought miracles before him, with which he deceived them that had received the mark of the beast and them that worshipped the image. These both, these runts, if you will, these dogs, these both were caught amidst the carnage, and cast alive into the lake of burning fire with brimstone. They are hunted down by God himself, hiding amidst like cowards, like dogs with their tails between their legs, and God hunts them down and takes these two, the devil and his antichrist, and he picks them out alive and he casts them into the lake of fire. You are done. Verse 21, and the remnant were slain with the sword of him that sat upon the horse, which sword proceedeth out of his mouth, and all the fowls were filled with their flesh. It's the cleanup. It is the valley of Hinnom. It is the stink being removed, for the beautiful Garden of Eden is about to grow. He's taking the ash heap, turning it into the garden. He's taking the total mess that the humanity has made all the way. We started in a garden, and we're going to end in a garden. And he'll even do the cleanup for us. That's amazing. That's astounding. Chapter 20, verse 1, "And I saw an angel come down from heaven with a big smile on his face, I'm sure, having the key of the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand. And he laid hold on the dragon and that old serpent, which is the devil and Satan, and bound him 1,000 years, the millennium. Into the millennium then we go. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done." Jesus' prayer is answered, and in we go. The book of Joel.
You've been listening to Time in the Vineyard with Pastor Teacher Jeff Turing. Today's broadcast was brought to you from the pulpit of Liberty Valley Church, Northfield, Ohio. For more information, you can call the church at 330-554-7606 or check us out on the web at libertyvalleychurch.org. That's libertyvalleychurch.org.